Okay, so we just wrapped up episode 100 of the podcast. So as of now, we are officially a real podcast by the time this drops tomorrow. Just left Bobby's house. We recorded this with Bobby Bones. To catch you up, we've been campaigning for Bobby Bones to come onto the podcast for probably about 6 weeks now. This started with a video that I made basically asking him to come on, and then we bought a cameo with Carly Pierce. Huge shout out to Carly Pierce for doing the cameo. And then the final thing was we took a billboard out in the middle of Nashville basically asking him to come on the podcast, and he said yes. We got this thing scheduled in about 4 days. So shout out to Bobby for fitting us into his crazy schedule and for being a good sport about being annoyed by us. And Clark over here, Clark jumped in, our producer Clark, with the name of his company that I always mess up the name of it. The Relationary Marketing. Did I say it correctly?
You said it. Yes,
Relationary Marketing.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a website?
Relationarymarketing.com. Relationarymarketing.com.
Clark Buckner, he's really good. He's always consistent. He shows up on time. He asked for an hour to set everything up for this interview, and we basically only had 15 minutes, and Clark got this done in 15 minutes. Audio, video, everything. He always just nails it. Clark with Relationary Marketing, you got to use him if you need any of this stuff. But I'm talking way too long. Bobby Bones on episode 100 of the podcast. I can't talk. I'm so excited. We're going to get into it right now. Here we go. Roll the clip. Let's go.
Oh, I forgot. These are not my mics. We're not even using these headphones, are we?
Okay.
Do I need headphones?
You might, just if you want them, you might even not.
Great. I'll take them. I always want them.
Yeah, I figured, right? Why not?
Every time I tell someone, nah, you don't need headphones, we end up playing something. And I'm like, can you hear this? Nah.
It's a rookie move. You need the headphones. Oh my God. Bobby Bones. I can't believe you made time for this.
I made time for other things around this. This was the center, you know, and at Thanksgiving you have the turkey.
Yeah.
And it's got its place, and then everything else goes around it. So this was the turkey. Everything else, they should be thanking you.
He's an absolute charmer. He knows exactly the right things to say to make me feel good. By the way, have you ever considered round glasses? Because I've been wearing square glasses like this since I was like in 10th grade when I started wearing glasses. Do you ever wish you could wear round glasses? Because I don't think I can pull them off.
You know, for me, I started to wear these glasses when this style. Well, my vision is terrible. I don't know what yours is, but my right eye doesn't work at all. It's got like...
I've heard that.
3 to 5% vision, right? My left eye is pretty nearsighted now, but I'm also really colorblind. So it all sucks from like the nose up. It's a struggle. And so when my vision was really bad when I was young, I wore a patch and got pounded a little bit. And I was like, I ain't wearing a patch anymore. So I wore glasses for a little bit. And then I was like, you know, my left eye was still pretty good. And the doctor was like, you need to cover your right eye though. Okay. But I didn't wear glasses at all for a while. And so when I was probably 19 or so, I'm a little older than you, I was like, man, I gotta wear glasses, but I don't have a very good face. You got a better face than I do. So I thought if I wear big glasses, it will take away from the face. People will stare at the glasses.
That's exactly how I feel.
Absolutely.
I feel that way 100%.
So then I said, who wears big glasses that I like? And two of my bigger inspirations
on Rivers Cuomo.
Rivers and Buddy Holly. On the music I like and kind of the personality that I've always had. It was those two. So it went to the squares. The problem is, and you'll know this too, it's tough to wear a hat straight forward because the bill comes down and shoves your glasses into your nose. So I wear them slightly crooked, and people be like, why are you trying to be a gangster? No, no, I have big glasses. I can't see crap. So if I wear a hat, I got to turn it slightly. So that is what I also am a gangster. So I'm offended that they even ask me
that
why
they
I'm
even
trying
bring
to
it
be.
Up. It's unbelievable.
Yes. So yeah, I have a pair of round, my wife likes it when I wear clear round glasses because she says I'm then out of the Bobby Bones character. And
so you do own a pair of round glasses?
I do, yeah.
Because I feel like I have a little bit more rounded face, and the square glasses always offsets the roundness of my face. So I've never not owned a pair of square glasses, but I see people like John Lennon wearing round glasses, and it's like...
You see John Lennon?
I saw him yesterday.
He's got a bigger problem than the glasses.
But you see the photos of people wearing round glasses, and it's like, oh my God, I wish I could pull them off, but I just don't think I can.
I got a pair of Harry Potter glasses that are like that, and then I have some clears. And so, but again... I don't wear them very often because I wear glasses to hide behind. It's like my superhero suit more than anything else. So I try to not. I have contacts, and when I was doing Breaking Bobby Bones on Nat Geo, a lot of the stuff that I was doing was me being shaken hard physically at something. I would get hit, I'd get thrown. And so they were like, hey, you're going to lose your glasses. I think it was the hockey one that I did when I was getting slammed.
Oh, that was an amazing episode.
So they said, hey, you should wear contacts. It's the only time I've ever put contacts in my eyes. And I haven't done it since because I hate it so much. But it was only one eye. I would just put it in one eye. So then I felt all whopper jawed. And I got one eye that's heavier than the other. So it was just weird. But you have a better face than I do. I would recommend round glasses, and I'm going to stay with these.
No, I can't go square. But hold on. We need to clear something up at the top of this, which is, you know, I don't know how many of these posts that I made that you saw, but everybody said to me, wow, this is crazy. I can't believe you got Bobby Bones to commit to all these stunts. And I said, what do you mean? And they were like, well, he's already booked, and you're just doing these stunts to, like, build hype for the episode. And I said, no.
I don't know what stunt. I'll tell you, the only two that I know of.
Yeah.
The one that I know of is the billboard. The one that I saw myself was the billboard, because I got tagged a whole bunch, and I get tagged on a lot of stuff, and so something almost has to hit 500 times for me to see it once, and not because I'm super cool, but because most stuff people telling me I suck, right? So I did see it, and I was like, oh, that's cool. And my buddy Mike, who is also, he produces a lot of stuff for me, writes with me, he was like, hey, you see the billboard? Because he knows, too, what is going to affect me, good or bad, because we're so close. And he was like, you should look at the billboard thing. And I was like, I just saw it. And he goes, and I knew when you saw it, you'd be like, yeah, let's do it. So that's the only one I really saw. But this morning, oddly enough, because my wife doesn't know anything about this, my wife at like 4 o'clock this morning, she rolled over and goes, because I get up, you know, butt crack early. And she goes, hey, on TikTok, I just saw somebody bought a cameo from Carly Pierce asking you to be on a podcast. And I said, oh, I didn't know about that one. She goes, yeah. I said, oh, I'm doing that podcast today, so that must be an older one. So the one I saw, but two I know about.
The Carly thing was interesting because I wrote in the description, I kept it super vague because I said, she probably doesn't even want to get involved with this. So I said, can you just ask Bobby for it to come on the Zach show? I kept it super vague. And I was so, shout out to Carly if she listens to this. Huge shout out to her. But like, what's it like? Because you have like millions of followers across platforms. Like, how do you sort through everything that you get tagged in? Do you see everything and then just ignore a ton of stuff, or do you miss most things that people tag you in?
You know who told me they like your show, though, before we leave this?
Yeah.
So I repost your billboard thing. I just don't want to forget this because I'm not throwing you off. But one of my wife's best friends is Abby Smyers, Dan Smyers, from Dan and Jay's wife. And so Dan and I were already buddies, but through that, we've become better buddies. We don't hang out a whole lot because I don't really hang out with anybody. But he messaged me, goes, I like that show. I listen to it. So Dan from Dan and Shay listens to your podcast.
You know, Dan's DM'd me about this. He DM'd me out of the blue, and he said, man, I love the show. Like, keep up the good work. And I wrote back to him. I said, oh, my God, like, that means so much. Thank you. Anytime you want to come on, open invitation. He never wrote back to me.
You can never open invitation to anybody. It's the same way as saying, hey, you should come over to the house sometime. Just let me know. If I said that to you, and we were C-level friends, meaning we saw each other occasionally, but we never, like, went to dinner or, like, we were never deliberate about spending a whole lot of time together, or you'd never been to my house before. And I said, hey, Zach, man, open invitation, man, hit it up. You would never reach out to me and go, hey, I'd like to cash in on that open invitation.
No, you're wrong. I 100% would.
You wouldn't. I know
wouldn't. If it was you, I 100%
okay,
would.
Okay, well, it's just two random people, Zach.
What's the, Bobby, you are so, this is so you. Like, when you interviewed John Mayer was like, take my number, text me. I felt he was,
I never
so
did once.
Genuine. You didn't even take his number when he offered it to you?
Let me see if I don't know. I haven't changed my phone number in 15 years. Let me see if
I feel like he was really genuine about giving you his number, and you completely shot it down.
Well,
you
let
said,
me see if I can, because I probably, if I know me, I did not keep it. Let's see, John.
What do you mean? You deleted it? You don't think maybe I'll
I never
keep
put
this?
It in my phone.
You never put in your phone?
No, it's not here. So, and I've hung out with John Mayer a couple of times, not in the past, not since pandemic. So before that, once when I was doing Idol, he came back. And we're not friends. And I don't say that in a bad way. He's not somebody that I would be like, that's a buddy. But he's somebody that a couple of times our paths have crossed and we've just hung out. Like, he came and did my radio show. That was kind of random. It wasn't really something set up. He was just in town. And it was like, I believe a DM exchange. Like, hey, yeah, I'll come by and do 10 minutes. He did an hour.
Yeah, it was a great interview.
He came backstage. No, I went to one of his shows. He was playing a theater in L.A., and I was just kind of back roaming around, And he was like, hey. And so we went back and talked for like a half hour. So we've had three or four of those experiences. But I would never keep his number because I would never text him. And so what am I going to do with his number since I'm never going to text him? So I just won't. So I won't do it. I don't keep sugar in my refrigerator. I love sugar. I eat sugar all the time. I wake up, I'd eat sugar. I eat cinnamon buns. For lunch, I'd eat cupcakes. And for dinner, I'd eat cake. But I don't keep it in my fridge because I'll eat it. Same reason I don't have John Mayer's number on my phone. I don't want to text him because he doesn't want me to text him.
But don't you think that sometimes you've got to just grab life by the balls and maybe text John Mayer every now and then if you had the number? I felt like he wanted you to have the number.
I felt like it became a bit. And again, you're asking me to remember from one time. I never watched it back because I don't watch anything I do back.
Yeah, I've heard that.
But I felt like that became a bit because Blake Shelton is kind of the same way where he's always like, I love you, Bobby. And I would never say it back because until my wife, I never said it to anybody. I've never said it to anybody. And so with Blake, it became a bit all the time. I'd see him somewhere. I went and stayed at his house one night in Oklahoma. He's like, I love you, man, before bed. And I was like, okay. So it was a bit. And I felt like the mayor thing became a bit too. And I like John. And that was a really cool interview from what I remember because I felt like we kind of went somewhere organically that I don't normally get to go with certain folks. But no, I would never text him. I don't have his number anymore.
You always talk about, like, your humor is very self-deprecating, and I think you're pretty open about, like, how you have OCD and you know, all these things. Did you think that when you made it, were you surprised that maybe some of those things didn't go away? Or did you think of those things were going to go away?
That's a great question because, yeah, I thought once I get to a point where I'm successful that I don't have to worry about paying my water bill or I get a pretty girl to like me, I'll be hot and rich, and that's how I feel about it. But you kind of never feel differently than how you've been wired. There are times where I feel better looking now because my wife's like, dang, you look really good in this type of thing. Like, she's really instilled a confidence in me, but I still know at my core who I am, right, and who I'm always going to see myself to be. And so the self-deprecating stuff is me just cutting somebody off before they can make fun of me when I'm 13. That's what that is. It's me. That I think that's how I developed a sort of sense of humor. It was, I know I'm about to get made fun of, or about to get beat up. So let me do it first. It's very 8 Mile. At the end of 8 Mile, when Eminem was like, all right, Clarence's parents have a happy marriage. And then he starts, and he goes in on himself. And then Clarence can't do anything back because Eminem's already trashed himself so much. So I think that is where it came from. I obviously, as a kid, was pretty good at it. And then felt that all the way through, probably on mid-30s, it's probably 28% lighter than it was, but there is still an extremely insecure person here. It doesn't matter how momentarily famous you get or how successful, how much money you have, that part of you never really leaves.
Do you still have this voice in your head that says, when I book that next TV show or that next thing, I'll become even more confident? And then you get to that milestone, you're surprised that you feel exactly the same? Or does it have an effect?
That's a good question. I struggle with accomplishments, period. I always have thought, hey, when I get this or when I get to do this, it's going to be different. But I had a few of those and it didn't change me. So now I don't feel that way at all. But I did think that for a long time. It's like, hey, whenever I get my own show, I'm gonna be so secure and like my place in radio or my place in television. And then you get it and nothing really changes. And so after a few of those things happen, you go, oh yeah, nobody really cares and nothing really changes. So you kind of got to work on yourself and in therapy or, you know, in the way that you choose to do it in a healthy way. But no, nothing changes. I mean, I guess my internal culture has changed a little bit because the culture takes a long time to change. And I think my wife is a part of that. I think having success for an extended period of time in radio has made me feel like, okay, I'm pretty good. And I should feel like if I were outside looking in and I looked at what I've been able to do, I would go, God dang, that's one of the greatest to ever do it. At the amount of stations, at the revenue, at the way that I built my own company when no one else believed in it. But I don't feel that way. I now am to the point where I'm like, okay, you're pretty good. And so, but that's how, and I also think that's part of the reason though I keep working so hard. And maybe one day I'll just be like, yeah, I rock, and then get lazy. I don't know. But I don't see that happening anytime soon.
They say that sometimes when men get married, like they let their appearance go or they get lazy or whatever. You still look fantastic. Have you noticed that at all, though? Like, did you start to pump the brakes a tiny bit, even though it still feels like you're going a mile a minute? Or is that, you know, is that stat BS?
My wife's hot, and I owe it to her to be hot, the hottest I can. And so, as of right now, I don't feel that where I can let it go a little bit, because she works so hard at, like, not just working out, but being physically healthy, eating the right things, working out and not just lifting weights. She's doing different stuff, and then mentally strong too. Like, she takes care of herself there as well. So no, I don't have it yet, but the goal is to have that. I mean, that's the goal.
The goal is to be able to pump the brakes.
My goal is just to be like,
let yourself
who
go.
Cares?
Eat the sugar in the cabinet.
That's it.
That's the goal.
That's the goal.
Really, I don't think so.
I would love to just go, let me just live life, baby.
Let me live for a day. My God.
And that's going to happen. I'm going to be 93 on my deathbed. I'm going to go, you know what? And I'm going to die.
And he's going to die.
That's going to be it.
I believe it. You really are like one of the best interviewers in media. Like, you seriously are. For people that I look to for inspiration and like pump up music when I'm going into something, it's like you, it's Stern, it's a short list of like, I don't even know who else. But you always have this way of like keeping everything under control, specifically in the Hank Jr. interview when he was like storming out of there. First of all, you kept him in the room, which I thought was interesting. Why didn't you just say, like, oh, if he wants to leave, let him leave. He can do whatever he wants. Why'd you keep him in the room?
You know, it's weird how, and I appreciate you bringing that up, because that happened, and it was kind of such a tornado, where Hank Williams Jr. was kind of a last-minute booking on the show. And, you know, when I was a kid, I listened to a lot of Hank Jr., because my grandmother listened to a lot of Hank Jr. She probably listened to more Hank Sr. than she did Hank Jr. on vinyl, but we definitely had my mom's 80s Hank Williams Jr. Part of her life. And so they said, Hank Jr. wants to come in. And he brought Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys, produced his record, and he was going to come in too. And so for different reasons, I'm a fan of both of them. And so I was like, that'd be great. Let's see what happens. And so they came, and maybe the day before, they're like, yeah, he's not going to play any of his songs. He's going to play some blues song. And I'm always a bit disappointed when an artist that has so many hits wants to stay completely away from all their hits. Like, I get it, but give me a little something. Like, if Keith Urban comes in, who I now have such a good relationship with, I can just say, hey, man, throw this in too, and it's fine. But even early on, he would make sure he'd give me a little something from Gonna Fly Now, or just, you know, something. But Hank didn't want anything to do with it, and he came in. And from what I know, I'm going to tell you what I know through like third hand from people that work in the show. Hank Williams Jr. was upset because he couldn't smoke his cigar inside. And I guess wherever he goes, they just kind of go, ah, screw it. Smoke wherever you want.
Is that an iHeart rule, or who comes up with that rule?
We're the only ones left in our building, honestly. I don't let people smoke inside.
Yeah. It's your studio.
Yeah, and I don't care who you are.
Yeah.
You know, you can't smoke inside.
Because Dan said he was the first guy to ever smoke in the control room of his studio. When he came, he said that at the end of the interview.
And so I was like, no, you can't. I don't care if it's a Pope. It's smoking inside.
Yeah.
Or at least don't ask. Just do it until someone goes, hey,
this 1972? Yeah, get out of here.
You can't. Yeah, it's not an airplane in the 70s.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, come on. Come on.
So he, and they were like, no, you can't smoke. And so, which again, don't ask. Just do it. Right. And so I think he was upset at that. I didn't know that at the time. Right. So they come in. He comes in and he's like, I just want to go smoke my. And I think he's kidding a little bit. So and he pushes on me. So I push on him back a little bit. And I'm like, just play the song, tab it. And he's like, well, can I leave then? I'm like, yes, just. But I already had him, and I didn't want it to be so quick that I didn't have a good print, like a good footprint from Hank Williams Jr. from the one time he's ever going to be on the show. So he tried to leave, and I was like, no, where are you going? And I knew he'd either turn around and sit down, and it'd be a funny moment, turn around and yell at me, and it'd be a compelling moment, wasn't so funny, but still be compelling, or he'd leave. Either way, we had something. And so it was just me kind of grasping, knowing that regardless of what happened from me battling Hank Williams Jr., it was going to be an entertaining segment. Now, that being said, he stayed. He played the song. He gave me a couple good things about his dad. It was fine if it were anybody else. Hank Jr. is pretty cool, but I got a couple messages from a prominent artist, one country, one not, and they were like, yeah, he's just kind of a dick. And they're like, he's just an old guy that's got his way forever and he's famous. So you just kind of expect it. He's kind of a dick. And I was like, yeah, I get it. And so that was it. And it was fine and it was good. I never thought much about it until people started texting me about it, like, whoa, the Hank stuff. And then a couple were like, yeah, he's tough. He's tough. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'd be tough too if I was like 70 and didn't need to do this crap.
Fell 400 feet.
Yeah,
you know,
the whole thing. So, like, I understood it. Like, I was like, oh, I get it. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So it was fun and it was fine. And we're talking about it now. So I guess, yeah, again, it was pretty compelling.
I heard you say a long time ago that for, like, interviews on the Bobbycast, you basically never prep because you like to go in and extract
not
things.
Not true.
Is that not true? Because you said that once.
No. Not never prep. I don't ever sit down and read. Okay, so I guess it's the definition of preparing. I know things. And I will make sure to know things, and I will make sure to have beats to go off of. But I don't have, at this point, all the information about their projects and stuff to go to ready in case I need to go to it. Now, I can have it on an iPad sitting here beside me, but I try my hardest, and I'm only probably 50% successful at this. I try my hardest to not have to go to it until the very, very end. Because if I can just keep it going organically, I feel like that's a win. Now, I will go to it at the very end because, especially to promote a project, because I don't want to screw that up. The reason that they're here is something that they want to put out to the world. They just come by because it's fun, and it might be fun sometimes, and sometimes it's not. But so, no, it's not prep, but I don't read and prepare a list of things to go down. What I do is if you walked in right now, and I was like, dang, black on black today, huh? So in the
summer. Music industry dress code.
Right. I'd be like, in the summertime, you're wearing black? Like, what is the deal with you? I always, and if you listen to these, for the most of them, I will just find something they're wearing or something they drove up in or something so small and kind of launch it off that and know what I want to get to. And sometimes that path is a big squiggly line. Sometimes I get right there depending on what they're giving me. And some days I'm just not a very good interviewer because I'm tired. You know, you never know. But never prep? No. Do I sit and look at prep the whole time? No. But I feel like I used to. But at this point, I have enough confidence in listening that I don't feel like I got to be loaded up with the next question always.
Is that because I feel like I've listened to a million interviews from tons of different people. I only know my prep process. Like, I have no idea what someone like you would do to prep for an interview. I just know what I do. But you're kind of explaining it.
Of course, you look at Wikipedia. You know, that's what everybody does first. And I'm part of that. I just want to make sure I didn't miss any of the broad strokes.
Yeah.
Something else I'll do is, like, let's say you were coming over. I'd type in, all right, Zach scandal. Enter. Just see what pops up from that.
Yeah.
Zach, girlfriend, wife. Boom.
Lawsuit. Zach's lawsuit.
So I look at that type of stuff to make sure that either I don't miss it or I don't hit it, depending on what, because I don't want to accidentally walk into something that I have no interest in talking about anyway. And sometimes I'll go after things if I think it's interesting that's, we'll call it scandalous. But sometimes I'm like, you know, I think that would not be good for the interview, what I want to get to even get near that, because people will clam up if they feel like you're walking them towards something. And so I'll also look up and learn information as to what not to talk about. But the key is, and you know this because you're actually really good at this, you're better than I am for where you are right now, because I was just terrible until recently when I was like, screw it, I'm just going to listen. You know, the key is just having confidence that you can listen to an answer and then go, yes, and, you know, like improv, yes, and.
Right.
When you have that confidence, it's awesome. And the, you know, the wherewithal to go, I got to get back to that project. We got to make sure they feel. And some artists, you know, it's very just super project driven. I will go back to the project first. So they feel like, okay, this is why I'm here. Some of them don't need it at first. Some of them do. And then you can get to some fun stuff. And sometimes you got to dribble it in. It's just, you know, your eyes are closed and you're feeling in one of those boxes and you don't know. That's what every interview is.
Yeah, right. So speaking of the project, by the way, I love the new children's book.
Thanks.
Here's what I want
to. By the way, it's not my. I'm not here to promote a project.
No, but we're gonna talk about the project because I've always like wanted to write a children's book, and what I want to know about the children's book, which I think is fantastic, very well illustrated, great message, great story. Is this the kind of thing that you wrote in? Like, this is a brilliant book, but I could picture you writing this in an afternoon, or I could picture you slaving over this for weeks. This is like Body Like a Back Road. Like, that's such a simple song. And when you talk to them, they say it took them forever to write it.
Well, because Sam rewrites.
Yeah.
And then rewrites. And then we'll, 4 weeks later, pick it up and rewrite it again, right? But the annoying thing about that song is not the song itself, but the people that go, oh, I could have wrote that. Well, then why didn't you?
That's how I feel.
And why have you never?
I feel like people are looking at this book and they're saying, I could have written that. And
And they probably could. And they probably could have. So this book started for me as I did a kid's music record. And so I was in a recording studio, and Eddie and I, my partner, the Raging Idiots, were recording a couple songs for the Idiots. And he was very late. He's not anymore, but he used to be late all the time. And I'd just leave him. I'd drive off in the car. I would lock him out of the studio, whatever. Love him. He's not late anymore. Let that be a lesson, everybody. Just lock him out. And so I wrote a whole kid's song just waiting for him. It was a planets. It's a song about the planets. And it was like, meet my good friend Mercury. It's closest to the sun. La, 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 la. And it was very Hickory Dickory Dock, Sir Mix-a-Lot type rap. And in that song, you'll also hear like a Buttermilk Biscuits chorus where it's like, my very energetic mother just served us 9 pizzas. And so I wrote the whole thing. And I was like, dang, I should do this as a kid's song. I had it all on like a piece of paper. And they came in and I was like, hey, can you give me some sort of beat? And felt like a, you know, Jay-Z mother. Just give me a beat. Just give me a beat. And they're like, boom, boom, and let me start at the start. And then I was doing the thing. And I was like, man, I'm so lame. But that rhymes. And I just taught kids how to do this. So I was like, why don't we just do like some kids songs real quick? And so Eddie and I wrote some of them, and I called Lauren Elena, and we wrote some. And I just had all these friends, Eric Pasley. We wrote, when I grow up, I can be whatever I want. And the song, the record got bought out by Cracker Barrel. They bought the whole thing, put it in their stores. And I was like, dang, this is easy. I can't sing or write. I just sold a kid's record. This is amazing. So I thought, well, I'll do a kid's book because I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. And I thought, I had to read a lot of kids' books as a kid, and even then I was like, these are lame.
I was going to ask, was there someone who was, like, was your grandmother reading you kids' books, or would you just kind of find them and teach yourself how to read them?
I was quick to read. I was probably 3.5 or 4 when I could read, so I was reading a lot of kids' books. The two things that my grandmother put in front of me were kids' books and the Bible. I've probably read the entire Bible a few times, too.
Forget the Bible, I'll read the kids' books. Yeah, is that kind of what 3-year-old Bobby was thinking?
Green Eggs and Ham or Galatians, you know? And
we're taking Dr. Seuss. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So I said, I'll just do a kids' book because I really found even some worth in that kid's record. And I would see entire classes at the end of like kindergarten graduation singing the song, When I Grow Up. I was like, dang, so had this idea for a kid's book from one of my songs. It was called Big Head Bobby. And Big Head Bobby was a song about a guy who had a humongous head, which I do. I have a massive head. And the town's...
Your head's really not that big, actually.
No, it is.
Is it deceivingly big?
Deceivingly.
Because it actually
looks... We measured heads on the studio because somebody said that. Oh, yeah. I got two things to tell you.
Is it the back of the head? Because it looks...
It's all of it.
What?
I'm telling you. And so we measured, and the show was shocked when they measured my head. And secondly, my wife the other night, I don't know where it came up, but I was talking about one of the first things I remember from her. She goes, you know, I remember about you. You were wearing tight clothes and you had a huge head. And I was like, what? That's one of your first memories of me?
Yeah, I guess
so. She was like,
yeah. Yeah, it's a big head.
So I had this big head and I have this song. And the song was about, even though people may make fun of you for it, that thing may be the most awesome thing about you. And so the dam's busting in this town. And this is the story of Big Head Bobby. He was the kid with a big old head. And he saves the town because the dam is, he puts his head in it and saves the town, right? And then they all love him. For the same reason they all made fun of him.
No, it's a beautiful message.
So I wrote this Big Head Bobby kids book, and I pitched it 9-10 places all over New York. People had meetings with me. Nobody wanted the book.
Hey, why do you need a publishing deal for a book? It seems like your platform's big enough.
Distribution. Make
just
the book.
To get into like Barnes & Noble's. And...
Yeah, my platform's big enough, but I don't want to spend any money on a book, and even then I'm going to be selling it from my house.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So it's really for the distro.
Everything is distribution now. There are great TV shows that are never seen because it's not on a platform.
That's the thing. You read Lefsetz, right? You read Bob Lefsetz? Because Lefsetz always says, content is not king, distribution's king.
And great content with great distribution, the freaking ruler.
Yeah.
So for me, that was it. I pitched to all these companies. Nope, 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 nope. Last company I talked to was HarperCollins, big book publisher. At the time, I didn't know the difference. But big fancy boardroom, so I thought they probably have a lot of money. And they said no, too. And I was leaving, and they said, hey, would you come back tomorrow? But I was in New York, and I was flying out immediately after that. I don't want to tell them I was leaving. I was like, yeah, of course, I'll come back tomorrow.
I'm here all week.
I'm actually in the hotel right next to this building.
Yeah.
And so I said, yeah. So I went back the next day, and they said, hey, we don't want a kid's book from you. The market's oversaturated. You're not famous enough. Like, people were very honest with me. And they said, but we're reading about your story. Would you tell us a little bit about your life? And I was like, yeah, sure. I'll make this very short. They offered me a book deal about my life. I didn't want that either because I didn't think I was important enough or people would buy it. And my ultimate, I hate failing. I do it all the time, and I'll attack it and fail, but I hate it. And so I was like, I don't, this is for sure gonna be a failure. So I said, I will not take the book deal, but let me write. I don't even know how to write a book. Like, I have a degree in writing, but not a book. And so I said, let me write you 30,000 words, since 60,000 is what the book was, what they wanted it to be. And I just wrote essays about my life. Good, bad, ugly, terrible. Some never made it. You know, some were expanded upon. And they said, all right, we like it. Let's finish it. And I was like, what? And so I wrote the other 30,000. So bam, bam, that book, bestseller for 4 weeks or so. I write a second book. Don't want to write a second book. I do a TED talk called Winning by Losing. I said, how about that one? I said, okay, fine. Wrote that one. Felt good about it. Bam, bam, bestseller for 2 weeks or so. And then it was, what do you want to do next? I want to do a kid's book. Oh, of course, a great idea. Why'd you never tell us this before? Well, I did tell it to you before, but you didn't listen. So what happened was that kid's book came from me wanting to do a kid's book, being told no, 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 and then getting to a point where they almost couldn't deny it. And it's the same message with me. You know, I think it can be irritating that I have a very central message, but I'm one person. I mean, that is my message. You don't have to listen to it all the time, but I have a very central message, which is you don't got to be cool to be cool. You can be completely different. You can be pounded on. You can, I mean, it doesn't, but there's something about you that's awesome. You just got to find it. You may find it when you're 9. You may find it when you're 49. But that was the basis of the kid's book too. But I use my dog Stanley. So Big Head Bobby's still in the book.
Yeah, right.
He's not the main character. I wanted him to be, but so I use Stanley. And so Stanley is different than all the other dogs. And he goes to school, and the other dogs are like, you're not part of, you're not cool like us. You're not la la la. But he finds a way to
saves the cat.
Saves the cat.
Saves the cat
falls,
the end
and
of the book.
He's a big fat dog.
Not to give away the ending.
Yeah, spoiler.
The Lunchbox ruined it for his kids on the show. Was it Eddie or Lunchbox?
I think it was Amy.
Amy.
She spoils everything.
She spoiled the ending for the kids. Yeah, yeah.
So, but that's where the message and the book came from. And the book was, it did wonderfully. I'm always surprised. I'm just always surprised. I would be like, you know, it's just never expected, and I'm always surprised.
Wait, so how long did it take to write the book?
Well, both. It took an hour, and then many, this word, you can't use this word because it's, I had to learn words like wobbly, gobbly, and dobbly, and which words were more textured for children, because I thought I wrote it with words textured for children. And at times my words were too young, and at times my words were too normal. And so that's where the rewriting
Who's giving
came from.
You, is it HarperCollins that's giving you that feedback?
Editor, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was just, that was the process, me fixing little things. I mean, like, oh, maybe the story shouldn't go here as quick. Maybe we need to find German Shepherds, picking the poodles to be snooty. You know, a lot of that went into it too, where it's not writing, but it's like what dogs are saying what. And so, yes, I didn't build a rocket. I mean, you know, I'm not Elon Musk, and it's not, you know, my stepdad worked at a sawmill. I didn't do that. But it took more time than you would think. But the initial book, the initial story was an hour.
An hour. But yeah. I think kids are going to go around the playground calling each other, you know, Coolio Drulio. I think that's going
to
stick.
Big shout out to Coolio, the 90s rapper, too, in that.
Coolio, the 90s rapper. Mm-hmm. And Captain Caucasians, Bobby's alter ego
that's
as a
true.
Rapper. I heard you say on an interview once that, you know, it's easy to be good at radio, but we're good at being on radio. I think you've said that, right? What does that mean?
That we're
What's
not very
difference?
Good at radio.
You're not very good at radio.
In what? Is in a traditional sense good radio. We don't hit our clocks at the right time. We don't do our commercials in the right length. I don't speak well. I speak too fast. Sometimes it's almost inaudible. My co-hosts have never been on the, I don't have a good voice. So it's the things that, and you start, and this is becoming a little more normal today because I consider radio at this point anything that you can hear. Like, we're all fighting for ears at this point, if you're a podcast or radio. Like, it's all the same. And so 10 years ago, we were such a weirdo show. We sounded like nothing else. We were unlike any other show. But what's cool is now with podcasts, there's just a lot of normal folks doing normal people things. So we're like, yeah, that's what we've been doing for a long time. Awesome. You know, we don't get as attacked as much now. But yeah, we don't do traditional radio very well. You know, I'll go over tops of hours. I'll stay long. All of that they teach you, we don't do right. But I think my group, that have all been my friends for a long time, we do good radio because we're not trying to do radio. And at times, I think it can be very compelling if it's super funny or it's super sad or it's super real or just super anything, getting any emotion at all. I think that's doing good radio. But I don't think you have to be on the radio to do good radio. You know, I think you could be doing a fantastic podcast and it's just, I just call it good audio, you know?
Do you think there's room for innovation in radio? Like, it feels like everyone always talks about, like, Stern created a segment of radio and it was raunchy and more crazy. And then when you were coming up, like, you were able to be super real and that was kind of innovative and new and fresh at the time. But like you've said, it feels like every podcast now is sort of tapping into that. Like, if you were coming up in the industry now, like, where would you take it? Or do you think there's room to innovate it? Or are we sort of, like, flatlined and now it's just marginal innovations?
I mean, I guess if you think it's flatlined, we just don't know what the next thing is going to be. Like, eventually there's going to be a time, and it's probably not going to be in traditional radio. Eventually there's going to be a time where I'm just so lame and old and out of touch that I'm just like, all right, Zach, these are your headphones now. Like, you're the freaking dude. Because that's just the natural part of creating content. Somebody that's always newer, fresher, younger, edgier, and not edgy in a dirty way, just there's a raw way to do it. But I don't have an answer to that in any way. But, you know, when we came to Nashville, we were so different than everybody else. It was brutal for me for years. And I grew up way more country than 99% of the people that were on my balls about it. And I'm just like, you guys are such hypocrites. You're fake country. And because I don't fit the yeehaw country standard that country radio has always had, you're saying I'm not country when you in your real life aren't what I am. But I just refuse to be fake and act like I don't like hip hop or grew up in the 90s with alternative. And or so that was tough for me because people were brutal. But then what happened was, this is everything. You brought up Sam earlier. Once we did what we did and we started kind of creating the standard, they launched shows constantly that were just like us. Or so they thought. They'd bring people over from pop and be like, this is the next one. This is the next Bible. But the problem was when I remember they did it in Chicago with two guys from like pop and hip hop. And I was like, that's never going to work because they don't know country already. Like, I had to fake it to be on pop back when I first started in pop.
Right.
And so they started to do all these pop country shows. And I was like, guys, you're missing the main thing. I grew up a hillbilly in Arkansas. Like, I was a trailer park kid in Arkansas. I wasn't a cowboy country, but I was rural, southern state, like, country accent. You know, I've had to work off that, but that was how I talked for a long time. When I went to speech pathology, they were like, you got to fix your eyes. And I was like, my eyes? What's wrong with my eyes? Oh, it's I. Oh. So I had to get my G's, my ING's, my I's, all that fixed. And I had to stop saying fixin' because that was my natural vernacular.
Yeah, right.
And so,
even though you were on country radio, you still felt you had to kind of change.
Well, this is before
right?
Okay.
This is me
being 22 or 23.
Being in Austin.
So when I came over and I'm doing country radio and they're like, you're not country. I'm like, you guys are the biggest dicks in the world. You have no idea what you're talking about. It's rough. We set the standard. They launched shows at, but none of the shows worked because they genuinely weren't fans of the format and had never lived the format. So we were that for a while. We're not anymore. Now we're just normal. We try to do a good show being normal. But it was pretty cool to be that. And I don't know what the next thing's going to be. I don't know if it's going to be in terrestrial or, you know, the podcast space is so cool because whatever the niche is, there's either a podcast for it or there should be. And if you master it, then you have your own audience. And there's space for everybody, meaning it's not limited. Where on radio, it's limited. You only got so much. You only get 60 minutes in an hour. You got to play, you know, 13 minutes of spots. You may play a song or two. You know, you got. But here, dude, you can go for 4 hours.
Yeah, right.
People may not listen, but you can go.
You can go. How did you know that you were so hated in Nashville? Because you always talk about this. I believe it's true that when you came here, everyone was hating you. Were people talking crap to you directly? Like, how did you know? Or was it something that you felt?
No,
were doors being closed?
There were articles written about me.
Yeah.
So that was an easy one to read the articles written on big industry websites.
But do you think that was really reflective of the actual industry versus a couple of journalists who thought, you know, this would be a good
clickbait? I believe
those
journalists, and they quoted people, well, they quoted unnamed sources, right?
Yeah.
I believe that that stood for a big part of the industry that made the decisions for a long time. I don't think that everybody absolutely hated me, but the listeners on the stations we went on also, it wasn't pleasant And it wasn't just because we were who we were, but here's what happened. We come over and we have no idea what stations we're going to go on, they're turning on, or what stations they've got morning shows that aren't doing well, they're putting us on in place of. But imagine you go on in 20 new cities where they took off 20 hosts that, and even though it wasn't a big rating in the places, people that listen still like that person. And that's the only people you're getting feedback from. So you're getting articles written about you. And you're also, anywhere you get on social media, people are just blasting you because you replaced so-so in the morning. We hate you. It was just a lot to the point where I told my show for a while, don't get on any sort of Bobby Bone Show social media stuff because it ain't going to be good for you. We're doing our thing. We're going to keep pushing through it. And eventually we'll pop. But, and I honestly didn't know if we would or not, but you have to keep thinking you will. And they did, and we did, and thank goodness it's here now. There's a whole revisionist history. There was a guy in my company who did not want me to be the morning show.
Yeah, you were like the fourth guy for this
absolutely.
Job. Like nobody, you weren't even the first pick. So, they wanted songwriters originally, right? They wanted people who, like, national songwriters were going to do this show originally. Wasn't that the original idea?
The fact that you know that, I've maybe only said that once or twice, so that you've, that's awesome. Awesome that you know that. So what happened was they were just trying to find a local morning show for the Big 98, the Nashville station. And they had tested two great songwriters in town, and I like them. And I didn't even know they were doing it till way later, but the Warren Brothers. I think it was the Warren Brothers. They tried a couple other people. They tried some radio people, but they could not find a show to go on and be the local morning show on the Big 98 because they had fired whomever came after Jerry House.
Yeah, right.
And people always go, "What's it like to follow Jerry House?" I didn't. I did. There was a show that got
you
fired
left
after
sign
Jerry
up.
House.
You left a sign in the studio
for a while. Anyway.
For a while, yeah.
And so they never hired any of those people, and so but they were never looking for a national show. But that's kind of where I got in the mix because they had promised me. My company years prior or a year prior, hey, when your contract's up, we're going to send you to New York or LA. Cause I'd spent all my own money, syndicated myself. I wouldn't say secretly they knew, but they didn't care because I was in Austin. They didn't give a crap. Like they didn't know what I was doing down there. And so I'd amassed like 20 stations and all of a sudden they're like, we gave him permission to do this. And you're like, yeah, you sure did. So
were you making good money in that? Cause when
no,
you started, you
not
were making
at first.
Like $13,000 a year, right?
Yeah.
But eventually,
I made in my first morning show contract $50,000 a year. But when I found out how to syndicate myself by buying these Comrex boxes, each of them cost $5,000 or $6,000. And once I paid for my first station, which is in Wichita, their phone lines, I made 19 grand. I went from 50 grand to 19 grand by adding a station. And I hired a producer who's Elena. And so I would add these stations. And I think for me to get back to 50 grand, it took like six stations. So it was me. And my show is now seven times bigger, and I was just now back to even.
Hmm.
And then once I would add, it'd be like, okay, now there's another $6,000 added on. But I wasn't counting money because stuff would break. And so then you have to pay for that. So I had built up to about 20, and I was probably at that point, I was probably doing six figures at that point, $100,000 or so a year.
Yeah.
And then the company was like, all right, your contract's coming up. We'll just resign you. I'm like, no. I want to... You know what I want to do. Okay, New York or LA, we'll give it to you. Well, Elvis Duran just re-signed his deal in New York. And I was like, okay, well, I guess it's LA. Seacrest re-signed his deal there. Yeah. And I was like, well, nowhere for me to go, guys. Deuces, I'm out. Because that other companies, for the first time ever, that also thought I was good. And so they were like, no. What do you want to do? You just name it. And they offered me the national alternative spot, which they were going to make a thing. And they do. It is a thing now. And they were like, go to Nashville. And so I went to Nashville. And they were like, hey, why don't you come here? And I was like, but there's never been a national. So we kind of figured out how to do this national show here that had never been done. And that's what happened. So they had offered it and had three or four guys in mind on the local show. But there was never an idea of a national show until they felt like I was going to leave. And they were like, oh, my God, let's figure something out. So then they said, hey, come do the national show. And I think it was like 30 cities or so. Now it's like 200, which is pretty cool. And then that was it. And so I was always the third or fourth guy they had imagined in this country role. But there was a guy that worked at the company who I like now and we're fine. But he did not. He fought tooth and nail about me coming in to do this show. But now he's like, oh, yeah, I was a big part of getting him here. And it's like, no, you weren't.
Get out of here.
No, you weren't. Shut up. But yes, there's a lot of revisionist history at this point.
There's something very brilliant about the simplicity of the show and also how I feel like you've been doing the same bits forever. But I can still listen and it doesn't feel stale at all. But do you get, like, is that?
It does to me sometimes.
I was going to ask.
Like, the benchmarks that we do all the time have just probably.
Tell me something good.
Researched so well.
Yeah.
That the company's like, you're getting massive ratings on this. So we don't know why you would stop doing it. And what's cool is they really don't push me a lot to do anything specific. The good or the bad, I never really had anyone to guide me through how to do radio because nobody cared enough. So I kind of figured out how I did it. Luckily, it caught a little bit and I started to get some ratings. And then when I started to get ratings and nobody cared, everybody thought, well, we should leave him alone because this is how he got here. So having no support actually ended up being my greatest strength because I figured out an odd way to do it. And once I started to have success, people thought, we can't mess with it because he's kind of got it going here. And that's still mostly a thing. We'll have research meetings and they'll go, the Friday morning dance party crushes. And they're like, we have some station managers that hate that you're playing Biggie on a country station or Weezer inside of a mix. And I don't have a DJ mix it. I had do it and it's terrible sounding. It's like I have two tape decks.
That's kind of what I love about that.
Well, that's what and I was like, man, people have to be so annoyed by the fact that I'm kind of messing it up. And they're like, no, it just feels like you're actually doing it. I was like, great. But tell me something good. I was in Austin 15 years ago. We did that segment at 5 a.m. It started to get slight research. Then they would make other shows do it. Then once we got here, they started making everybody do that segment because it was researching so – and we didn't invent good news. But what we invented is really highlighting it consistently and often and making it a big part of who we were. So there are so many shows that do that segment. And I got to – we talked about Ryan earlier just to give him just a bit of respect. He actually called and said, hey, they said, hey, we need to do this. I need to do this segment. I want to do Tell Me Something Good, but I want to call it that. Are you okay with that? I want to do your segment, but I just want to ask permission. And I was like, are you kidding me? Dude, you could just call and have me fired and say you invented it. And so he does Tell Me Something Good the same way, but he was so cool about calling to go to –
Does he use the theme song?
It's in a clip, yeah.
He uses the clip?
Yeah. So – super cool of him to do that. But yes, I do get tired of it because we do it four times a day, every single day. I think if you ate filet mignon four times a day, every single day, you got a massage four times a day, you'd be like, oh my goodness. So yes, it does get a bit tiring with that. But on the other side of things, we kind of do whatever we want. And so, you know, with artists, we would get this research back in that, especially when radio changed their metrics on how they measured. Instead of in some cities, you still write in a book, and some it's monitored and it's picked up through a little box. And so they would get the research and go, yeah, for bigger markets, interviews, they don't do well with normal shows. And I'd be like, oh, they say, however, when you do yours, it's a bit different because people don't feel like — this is radio only, not like a extended podcast — they don't feel like a star is in and you're like, oh my goodness, we're so lucky to have you. They said they feel like it's two peers talking because a lot of times you've been on the road with them. At one point, maybe they opened for you or you did or they said it's a different dynamic. So they let me continue that, which was kind of brave on their part. And again, I'm just lucky that I had no resources early on and had to learn to do it the really hard way because it just made the easy way so much easier.
Yeah, when you finally figured it out.
Yeah, when you got it and you did it your own way, people don't question the way you did it because they can't understand it. They didn't think of it this way. If you're doing it like everybody else did it, they're like, well, you can make some improvements here and here. And I still get – I got one person that I listen to that's like, hey, that bit or that
– Who is it?
His name is Rod Phillips.
Oh, yeah.
Now he runs the company, but right. Rod was the first guy to ever come to Texas when I was in Austin and go...
Why do you trust him, though? Seinfeld always talks about network notes. He says you never trust the network notes. Isn't he kind of the network?
I guess his position now is, but we've been together for 16 years.
Yeah.
And so I was doing mornings in Austin. He was the very first person outside of my station to ever fly into town and to say, hey, man, you're really good. And he was in Miami just running a pop station. And he was like, I'm not trying to hire you or anything, but at one time we talked about you coming down to do like afternoons. But I remember he took time to come down, and then he put me on my very first date. I was paying for it, but after I'd gotten Wichita, Amarillo, and Lubbock, he said, hey, I think I can clear you off another station or two down here. You got to pay for it, you know. But and so he was the first guy to ever invest in me and tell me that I was in any suit ever. And so he told me and convinced, he's like, Nashville's a thing. You should do it. And I felt like I should do it, but hearing it from him and having 16 years of the good and the bad. And then when his job opened up, he didn't have it. He was just, I fought hard to get him in that position. Like, I was probably what pushed him to get that job. And so we've just been there for each other. And he's told me I suck. So I trust him when he tells me I'm good. And because I trust him to tell me I'm good, I do believe him when he says, hey, this isn't right. But I don't always have to agree with him. And we don't always agree, but he's the guy that I will go to.
Okay, makes sense. Wait, we're running out of time. Morgan, how much time do we have left?
How much time do we have left?
How much time do we have?
Oh, we got 10 minutes.
We got 10 minutes. Yeah. Okay, so this new show, Snake in the Grass, this is like the best concept for a show I've ever heard among these like outdoor survival reality shows. This is airing in August. What is this? So four people are going to be in the wild.
Basically, let me do it quick because I got some other stuff to talk about. I don't care much about my projects, but I appreciate you bringing it up. It's just, can you spot the liar?
Yeah.
One of them's doing all this stuff. Which one's lying while they're doing it? Somebody's actions are not, and you're watching them compete. You're watching them talk. So it's just spot the liar. There's some fancy stuff like high flying, people dying. Nobody dies, but you never know. There's, you know, animals and jungles, but it's like a social experiment. Can you tell when somebody's full of crap? And it's interesting in that way because I never knew while I was doing the show. I had to also watch and see who, and I wasn't always right. And I'm right there. I'm watching them in person.
Do you know? You don't know who it is?
Now I do because I was there when it was revealed. But I didn't.
But
while
in
I was
the
doing,
moment,
no,
you,
never. They
you
never
know.
Told me. And Morgan went with me. We were there the whole time. And it was brutal. It was a brutal shooting. We were there. I would do the jungle for 12 hours and go do radio for 6. And it's brutal. I hope people watch it. And if they do, great. If they don't, I'll try to get into something else. But I think it's a really interesting show. And it's who's the liar? You're just watching people trying to figure out who's full of crap. Because we all think we can tell when someone's lying to us.
Yeah, right.
Here's what I want to say. We got 8 minutes. Let me show you this real quick.
Yeah.
I'm going to show you just why we have 8 minutes. Because I'm not full of crap just going, oh, I don't have any time. This is my schedule today. So all the red block. This
color
is
color-coded in red. Bobby's favorite color.
Everything's red.
Yeah.
So this is all radio, right? But then this ends after radio. And it's like at a TV shoot. I had hair and makeup at the TV. BBC call. This is you. So I have stuff all blocked up all the way through.
Yeah,
so
right,
I'm
right.
not making it up.
No, I believed you 100%.
I'm just making sure. I'm not making it up. Seacrest is the one that was like, schedule out every minute and make sure you get to your next thing the minute you're supposed to get to it. If you got to go, you got to go. But set that. He was like, set the expectation of everybody that when it's time to go, it's time to go. So, but that being said, I'm super glad that we could do this. But here is this the 100th episode?
This is going to be the 100th episode. We made it.
Let me say this about 100 episodes. And I always thought you were making fun of me. I didn't know if this was going to happen and this was like some joke.
That, no, because you made that comment and that made me, I got like hot about that because I was like, that is the opposite of what I was trying to do. Here's the thing. I looked up to you in college. I wanted to move to Nashville so badly. I would listen to you every morning.
Where are you from?
I'm from New York originally. I went to school in Boston. I would listen to you every morning because I was dying to move to Nashville, and you gave me like a window into Nashville
with what was
happening. Like, you kept me up to date, and I basically wanted to like, you know, follow this path. But on the 100th episode of your podcast with Christian Bush, you said you're not a real podcast until you hit 100 episodes. So I listened to that randomly, and that was what this whole campaign, that's
good.
What sparked the whole campaign was like, I have to have Bobby on the 100th episode because I'm not a real podcast until I hit Bobby, you know, until I hit the 100th episode, and I can't do it without Bobby Bones.
Well, I feel like you're Pinocchio now. You're a real boy.
By the way, I was going to put Pinocchio on the billboard. I was actually going to Photoshop me onto the – that was one of the ideas I had for the billboard, and I thought Disney was going to sue me.
Probably better not to.
Probably better
it
not to.
It worked the other way.
Right, exactly.
Here's what I meant by that. First of all, I was talking about me. It was my 100th episode, and I was like, I did not feel like I was a podcast until I was 100 episodes in. Secondly, working with buyers of podcasts all the time now, they want shows that they know if they buy are not just going to dissipate in 15 more episodes. So from the agencies that I work with, one of the things they'll look at is how many episodes they've done. Now, if they're wildly famous, maybe they're going to that podcast for a reason. If it's Johnny Depp doing a podcast, you don't go to that because he's got 500 episodes. But if it's somebody like us who they may not know because they're on a coast, they're like, okay, well, have they done a bunch of episodes? What's it look like? And usually the number is 100 where they're like, we feel like we can invest in that podcast and spend money on it. And it's still going to be here in 8 months. Where if we want to do a second campaign, we can.
Right.
So that's kind of what that meant. Because to me, if without 100 episodes, I wasn't a real podcast because people weren't buying the show really. Once I hit 100, I was rich. Not really, but
yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's what I meant. But now you're a real podcast. Congratulations.
Oh my God, Bobby. Thank you so much.
Of course. So what's the deal? What's the deal here? Let me ask you this. You're doing this show and you're talking to, I was looking at even the people who comment on your podcast. You have a passionate following of even of new artists who like are like, let's go. It's awesome to see. And in our Venn diagram, we have a couple on the same, like Abby Anderson.
That's right. Yeah.
Like love Abby. Taking Abby out with me on the road, think she's so talented, and she was like fighting for you. She could have easily texted me and been like, "Hey, Zach." She didn't though. Be mad at her. She never texts me. But like, what's the dream? What's the dream? Is it to do 5,000 of these and make this massive? Is it to right? And this, if this is the dream, that's awesome. But what's the dream?
Really to grow across like media. So I also run a newsletter called the Nashville Briefing.
Nashville Briefing?
It's called the Nashville Briefing.
National or Nashville?
Nashville okay. Briefing. I have a gift for you, actually.
This
is a good time to get. Here, wait.
All right.
Where's my backpack? We moved the backpack.
It's over here.
The backpack's, wait, Clark, can you pass me my backpack? So I run this newsletter, the Nashville Briefing, and it's really grown to now thousands of people in the music industry read it every day. And really the dream is like I look at someone like Dave Portnoy, who is a personality. Thank you, Clark. But who also runs a company and has,
right.
you know, a media empire he's built. So this is my gift to you. This is in a bag so that I can prove that it's brand new and unused. My newsletter is called the Nashville Briefing.
What's in the Nashville? Because I'm going to
These are official Nashville briefs for you.
That's funny. That's funny.
Nashville briefs.
So, and they're extra small.
It was the last size I had. I'm sorry, Bobby. This came together so fast. I would have ordered another size, but I feel like you're a small person, right?
You know what, Bob?
Caitlin might be able to fit in those.
Listen, here's the bothersome thing about you saying that. This shirt, you think the shirt fits pretty good or no?
Yeah, great shirt.
Right? You think it fits pretty good?
Yeah.
Yeah. So our constant disagreement is what size shirt I should wear.
Really?
And I like to wear mediums. And she's like, nope, you're small. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm a small? I'm 6 foot tall. I'm 170 pounds. She's like, you're small. What do you mean I'm a small? I can do 100 push-ups, right? You're a small. This is a small. And she's like, I told you, it looks good. And I'm like, I just don't want to be a small. I guess there's just some part of me that doesn't want to be small. Like my masculinity, it's that same thing. I'll wear a purse. You know, I'm cool with that. So it's kind of tangled in what I feel is masculine about me and not. But I will wear these extra smalls at least once.
One time, yeah. Take a photo.
They're stretchy, though.
They're stretchy.
So what's the purpose of the Nashville Briefing?
So the Nashville Briefing is an industry source. So people in the industry read it, and it covers, like, the global music industry, but also what's happening in Nashville. Insider information. It's a little more industry-leaning, though, as opposed to, like, celebrity gossip, et cetera.
You make any money off of it?
I do, actually.
Do you?
Yeah, from trade ads.
That's it? Awesome.
That's it.
What about this? No, I'm not that's it. I'm saying that's it.
No, right. The labels buy advertising. I've got tech companies who buy advertising.
Awesome.
It's cool. I've built it over the past probably 2.5 years, and it's my main source of revenue right now. It's all I do. I run this newsletter. I do this podcast.
Dude, that's good for you. You found a way to do something you like to do and pay your bills.
That's it. Yeah.
And that's the win. Everything else is cool and awesome, and it's neat. But the biggest win is that if you can do something you love and just live. It's all if all the crap that I have now goes away and I still get to do what I do and pay my bills, that's all I ever wanted to do. And it's really cool that you're doing that works like that, because it does. And I know a few businesses that do that and make money, but for you to launch it yourself, congratulations, man. That is awesome. Do you make money off the podcast?
Not so much. I've had moments where I've made money on the podcast. ACM actually bought about a month's worth of advertising. I made a little bit of money from that. ZipRecruiter early on bought a little bit of ads.
How do you sell ads?
Through the podcast or for the newsletter?
Through the podcast.
So I don't really have a great system for it. People reach out to me and I kind of hustled early on, but I got a lot of no's. And you know, the funny thing about the podcast is like I do the podcast for free. If I can make money off it, that would be incredible. But like when like Seth Godin has a quote where he says, people always say, like, do what you do if you knew you wouldn't fail. I like to say, like, what would I do if I knew I would fail? Because if I knew I would fail at this podcast, I'd still keep doing it. It's my favorite thing I do.
Right. Like, what can you do and they tell you no, but you keep doing? I wrote that in my second book.
Yeah.
I don't know. I always say adult book, but then my second adult book, but then it sounds like porn. But Fail Until You Don't, where I was like, it's that. It's like, what will you keep doing even though either you're losing or people tell you no? Like, then that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, right.
And so I'm inspired. That's awesome. That's really cool that I mean, and listen, I think there's probably an avenue at some point sooner or later for us to work together and make the money off the podcast, because you've shown the hardest thing to show, and that is you just show up and you put in the time and you do it. You can get better at something, but can you show up all the time? I mean, I have friends that are so talented but won't put the work in. And then I got friends who put the work in and aren't that talented. Of the two, which do you think generally are more successful?
Ones show up.
The ones that show. And I'm one of those. I don't have a real distinct talent. And I think sometimes why people get so pissed that I've had success is because they're like, how does he sell, you know, 2,000 and 3,000 tickets a night when he's playing music or doing stand-up? Like, he's not that. I've just worked so hard at being pretty good that every once in a while really good comes out. And I just keep showing up and just keep trying to represent the same people that I represented earlier, you know, and good for you. Cause that's really cool. Like I'm actually quite inspired by that. So keep it up. I think at some point we should talk about if you want to blow this thing up. I mean, it's like, you could just do my job. You look like me anyway. So do the Bobby cast and just don't even say you're you.
I feel like we're opposites. Cause my favorite color, I swear to God, is blue. Everything I wear is blue. You're obviously red. So I think about that's fine. We both wear square glasses and we both have like a color that we both love.
I do associate myself with red very much so, but it's really the only color I can see through the whole spectrum.
Mm.
So that's a big part of it. Like I can, most dark colors all turn to black to me. I'm so colorblind with dark colors. Red has to get way deeper dark for me to lose it into black. So my color blindness was a big part of that. I could always see when reds didn't match, did and didn't match. So yeah, that's it. You're just crazy. But me, it's a real eyeball thing. But listen, I appreciate you guys coming over and setting up and doing this and letting me be the 100th episode and going, you know, putting a billboard up. How much did that cost?
$250 for a half hour. And let me tell you something. I was debating it because I had a lot of friends who were telling me that you were going to like arrest me or like put a cease and desist out or something. My last stunt, if you had said no to the billboard, I had one more stunt in the bag.
You're kidding my wife?
What? Yeah, exactly. My last stunt in the bag, Bobby, and thank God you said yes, because this was going to be a hassle. I was going to drive to Hot Springs to your sign where it says the boyhood
Mount
home.
Pine.
Mount Pine. Yeah. Excuse me. I was going to drive to Mount Pine. I was going to take a photo in front of that sign. That was going to be my
hilarious next
move. That would have been great, right? One of my best friends said he's going to kill you. He's going to arrest you if you do that. I said, no freaking way.
Somebody that has made his career of doing stuff like that would never get upset at something like that.
That's what I thought. Yeah. I knew that was going to be the answer. That clip right there is for my friend because I'm going to play it for him and send he was wrong, basically.
I think, it's been a real treat to actually do that. You're really good at this.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're really good at this. So keep showing up and you can do whatever you want to do as long as you keep showing up because you have it. Now, I mean, it took me longer than it's going to take you to kind of figure out how to do this. You kind of have already got it. But yeah, congratulations. Thank you for the 100th episode.
And Bobby, the
200th,
thank you.
I'll tell you what, we can go ahead and schedule the 200th now.
Great.
Whenever you get there, I'll probably cancel by then. Did you see my sign, just don't get canceled today when you came in?
Was that on the... No, I missed that.
No, it's not outside what? The front of the house. He's like, is that it when you drive in?
Was that a big billboard somewhere?
You may see it on the way out. I've got a sign that says, don't get canceled.
Yeah,
that's
the
only goal. I just don't want to get canceled. I'll have moments. I've had little flickers of almost being famous. And then I have times where nobody cares. And it's all the same to me at this point because fame is nothing. It's stupid. It's fleeting. And I was with a friend of mine who is actually pretty famous. And this just shows you what we know and feel about fame. And we're talking about, I've had some security issues in the past, some big ones. And he was like, it's got to be weird for you. I went to one of his shows. And the whole time, I had people coming up to me and taking pictures. And he was like, I'm really sorry I put you on the edge. Because he gave me tickets, free tickets to come to a show. He said, I'm really sorry I put you on the edge. I should have never done that. And he could see the people taking a picture with me the whole time. I wasn't mad about it. I shouldn't have sat on the edge. And that's my fault too. So, and I was happy to do it because I was in a place. And if I'm out in a place and I'm not eating or I don't have any kids, but if I was with kids, other than that, I did this. Come say hello. If you like what I do, I'm so grateful for it. I owe you a picture. Now, don't grab me. I don't like that. But if you're like, hey, let's take a picture. I love it. So he saw it and it was like, what's it like being like capital F famous? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he was like, he's like, I'm like lowercase F famous and it's weird, but you're like capital F famous. You have like TV shows. And I'm like, you're out of your mind. I said, I'm like Amos. Like, I don't even have an F faint. But it's everybody's perception of who and what. It's so split now. And you got a TikTok star who can have 10 million, but could probably also walk through the mall. Nobody even know who
it is. Yeah, right, right.
So it's just about finding your place now that you own and you love and just covering it with your own blanket. And that's you. And you're doing it right now. And it's super cool to see. So thank you for having me.
Bobby, thank you for coming on, so last minute. We fit this in with like, you know, 4 or 5 days. We got this scheduled. Thank you so much. 100 episodes. We're officially a real podcast now. We'll wrap it there. Bobby, can't thank you enough.
Thank you
so much.
It's awesome, dude. Oh.